Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It's Tuesday, October 11th, 2016, just 4 weeks until Election Day. Our daily free news and comment podcast is now available on YouTube, makes it easier to access for many people. On just about every device and platform, you can get YouTube. 4 weeks remain. The polls show pretty clearly that Donald Trump is in free fall. The corporate media has figured out that it's very likely that Hillary Clinton will be the next president. And as a result, all of the media focus now is on the decline and fall of Donald Trump. Oh, yeah, there's a little coverage about, you know, would Hillary actually go to jail if Donald Trump becomes president? And there is some discussion about who's on the campaign trail today and that sort of thing. But what is stunning to me is that since Friday, when WikiLeaks dropped over 1,000 hacked emails, many of which are deeply embarrassing and expose a whole lot of problematic behavior on the part of Team Clinton. And what we're getting from the corporate media is downplaying or just downright ignoring the contents of these emails. And it appears that by blaming it on the Russians, that many people, including top editors, have said, oh, well, then we're just going to dismiss the entire issue. Because we don't want to be playing with the Russians, do we? And as we dive into this today, I want to think back to the tactics that were used by Karl Rove in 2004. The tactics that ended the career of CBS News anchor Dan Rather. Because Rather, on a primetime news magazine, reported that George W. Bush had evaded his service in the Air National Guard in Texas. The records indicated that he hadn't shown up, he'd been reprimanded. And because one single document that Dan Rather used may have been a plant, could have been a trap that was laid by friends of Bush, but one document was doctored. And Karl Rove was able to show that the typeface that was used on that document did not exist at the time the document was created. And IBM Selectric was suspected as the source of the font and the typeface. And from that, Karl Rove just pulled that single thread, and the entire case against Bush unraveled. The rest of the media ran away from it. They were afraid of being locked out of the next Bush administration. And we have a similar tactic in play here right now. Because there is substantive information, very troubling information in these emails. The Los Angeles Times on its homepage website today had zero coverage. No, I take that back. The LA Times had a single story. It's the Washington Post that had zero coverage on its homepage. And I'm going to detail in a moment the very insignificant coverage offered by the New York Times. And this information, as I say, and you're going to hear about it as I leaf through it here for today's podcast, I think is critical to evaluating whether Hillary Clinton is suitable to be the next president of the United States. And I know that we're all supposed to forget about this kind of critical thinking at a time like this because the future of our nation is at stake. We can't allow Trump to become president. Therefore, we must accept Hillary Clinton no matter what. And I reject that. I know I'm in a minority, and I know that she is most likely to become the next president. And I know plenty of people in the media with no spine and who want to get along, want to get access in the new administration, who are going to go soft, if not entirely limp, on these issues. Because after all, who wants to ruin the coronation of America's first female president? And so Right here is the single story I found at the LA Times. And it's not a very significant story. What it explains is that Brian Fallon, who's now a spokesman for the Clinton campaign, he exited the revolving door. He was working at the Justice Department, clearly had friends over there. And in 2015, May 19th, he got a heads up from one of his buddies that in the case that had been brought regarding the Clinton emails from the group called, what is it called? Judicial Watch, that's it. Quote, DOJ folks informed me there is a status hearing in this case this morning so we could have a window into the judge's thinking about this proposed production schedule. Now, this is not consequential. That is the only story that the LA Times has chosen to put on its homepage today about these serious issues. And the Beltway newspaper, the Washington Post, appears to be ducking it entirely. Over at the New York Times, they are delving into it, but it is not featured on the homepage. You have to dig down and find a series of articles that have been written about the emails since they surfaced on Friday. So the Times chose to take a look, for example, at the interaction between the Clinton campaign and New York's liberal mayor, Bill de Blasio. And it's an interesting political story about how the Clinton people keep him at arm's length because he's too damn liberal and because he is promoting a $15 minimum wage. But the Times doesn't mention much of the detail and the context. They go for the personality clash and the cold shoulder that Team Hillary gives to the mayor of New York City. Next, we have an email that shows that on the day that Hillary lost the primary in New Hampshire by 22 points to Bernie Sanders, there were a sequence of emails. One person on the ground was saying that Bill Clinton was depressed. He was despondent. Quote, he's losing it bad today. And that came from Bill's chief of staff, Tina Flournoy, who wrote to John Podesta. And it's Podesta's emails which have been hacked. And so he's a central player in all of what you're about to hear. Now, the Times also went heavy here on an email chain from March of 2015 when four aides fine-tuned and sought State Department approval for a Twitter post in which Mrs. Clinton would address for the first time that she had used a private email server. And there's one other tidbit here about the vicious payback that was visited on Hawaii's member of Congress, Tulsi Gabbard, because she supported Bernie Sanders. Elected officials who supported Sanders over Clinton felt the wrath of the network when Gabbard resigned her position at the DNC to endorse Sanders. Two longtime Clinton supporters wrote to Gabbard to say they would no longer raise money for her, and then they forwarded their emails to Huma Abedin, the right arm of Hillary Clinton, and John Podesta. And one of them, exalted, was trying to say hammer dropped, and there's a typo, it ended up hammed drop. So, oh, and there's one more here. This is a series of blurbs that were collected into an article called Highlights from the Clinton Campaign Emails, How to Deal with Sanders and Biden. And I'm just going to tick off a couple of them for you here. Emails show the anxiety her team felt over making her opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline public. The Clinton camp seemed unprepared for the insurgent campaign of Sanders. The campaign did get a heads up from Donna Brazil, from a DNC official who, because she's African-American, learned about a Sanders African-American event and tipped off the Clinton people. Clinton's team keenly aware of how vulnerable her Wall Street ties made her appear next to Sanders. Now, all that is, you know, modestly interesting. You might find it informative. But it pales in comparison to what I'm about to share with you. And I have to give credit to Glenn Greenwald and the team of reporters at The Intercept, And I know some of my listeners are skeptical of The Intercept. I know Sibel Edmonds has attacked them and raised questions without really finding any serious compromises or other issues that I think deserve closer scrutiny. And Greenwald and his team have exposed, using the very same cache of emails, some very serious issues. For example, John Podesta is on leave from the Center for American Progress, the liberal, so to speak, Washington think tank that he started back around 2000. And let me disclose here that I've had a long-running relationship, it's not currently going on, but with the Center for American Progress. And 10, 12 years ago, when I was hosting a syndicated radio show, I used their studios in Washington. I frequently interviewed their think tank fellows. I did a weekly feature with their director of research, Faz Shakir. And at the time, as we were trying to launch some media to balance the conservative media in this country, I felt comfortable with the Center for American Progress. I knew they had a democratic agenda. But people like Faz Shakir were principled individuals who could deliver some spin, but they never compromised their own personal values. And I really want you to read this piece. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast, as I have all of the articles that I'm citing here today. And what Greenwald exposes is that the Center for American Progress in recent years has simply become an arm of the Clinton campaign. And in preparing for Hillary's run this year, they cozied up to Israel and AIPAC. And next week, Neera Tanden, the president of the Center for American Progress, is hosting Benjamin Netanyahu for a conversation about how to improve the partnership between Israel and the United States. Pure puffery. Pure politics. And this is being done to separate Hillary Clinton from the Obama White House, which does not enjoy a good relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu, as just about everybody knows. And so this is just the tip of a really ugly iceberg, because this visit by Netanyahu next week is also obviously going to include some sort of an endorsement of Hillary, whether it is direct or inferred. And what we have learned is that in this shift, it occurred over the last 3 or 4 years, writers for the Center for American Progress blog, which is called Think Progress, have been censored for writing honest criticism about the state of Israel. And some of the crackdown, the censorship, has been driven by Barney Frank's sister. Now, a lot of people, for whatever reason, don't know that Ann Lewis, who has been tight with the Clintons since the 1990s, is Barney Frank's, I think, older sister. And she is a staunch advocate for the state of Israel. She conducted her own little survey of the writing at the Think Progress blog and slammed Neera Tanden for what she considered to be an anti-Israel bias. Part of her critique was there are no warm words for the state of Israel, no mention of rocket attacks being launched from Palestinian territory. And Faz Shakir, who I have deep respect for, left the Center for American Progress a couple of years ago to go to work for Nancy Pelosi over in the House Leadership Office. I haven't talked to Faz in years, but my guess is that he got uncomfortable with the constant pressure, and there are emails that Glenn Greenwald publishes in this article where Faz Shakir politely but firmly takes on Neera Tanden over her efforts to micromanage coverage of Israel to please supporters, AIPAC, and donors to the Center for American Progress. So I think that this is really significant. It shows that the machinery that supports the Clinton campaign is biased extremely toward Israel. And I think that this is information that every American voter needs to have. Now, you may have heard of Howard Wolfson, a longtime top aide to Hillary Clinton. He ran the health care reform back in the 90s. He's still in the loop there. And he saw a piece at the Think Progress blog that he didn't like. And he sent an email with the link to that article to Neera Tanden. And he simply put in the subject line, "For the love of God." And that caused her to write to Faz Shakir and Judd Legum. And Neera Tanden said, "Is it wise to throw around the Israel issue in this?" So Neera Tanden is not interested in using the Center for American Progress to foster progressive thinking, independent views, controversy that includes criticism of, sacred cows. And I consider this to be a really damaging exposure. I'm glad Glenn Greenwald has brought it to us, but I will note again that the corporate media is not interested. They'll tell you about, cold shoulder for Bill de Blasio, and Chelsea Clinton's been fighting with Doug Bland over at the Clinton Foundation. But there isn't a mention of the Center for American Progress and its coziness with AIPAC and the State of Israel. Oh, and there's more. I teased a moment ago how the New York Times wrote about the de Blasio cold shoulder. Well, one of the reasons is de Blasio was stumping for a $15 minimum wage. He gave the campaign a tip-off a couple of weeks before he went public back in April of 2015. And one of the people he wrote to was John Podesta. And then Neera Tanden, responding to a question from Podesta, "Should we care about this?" She said, "Well, we haven't supported $15. You'll get a fair number of liberal economists who say it'll lose jobs. Most of the rest seems fine, but I'm not sweating it." And The Intercept points out that this was only 2 weeks after thousands of workers in over 200 American cities took part in demonstrations asking for a $15 minimum wage that was mostly unprotected fast food workers. When I say unprotected, they don't have union protection. And they risked their jobs to protest for a higher minimum wage. And so this progressive think tank, where you would think that the interests of workers, middle class people, would be paramount. Well, no, the donors to the foundation, the corporate interests, they set the agenda at the Center for American Progress. Now, here's another one from Greenwald. He published it just today. The headline reads, "In the Democratic Echo Chamber, Inconvenient Truths are recast as Putin plots." And as I have been saying for, since August, I do not believe the claims that have been made without any evidence that Russia is responsible or even solely responsible for the hacks of the DNC and the leaks that we've been seeing. And I want you to read this Greenwald article because he details why it is a smear. It is a lie. And while there appears to be one document that was doctored that has surfaced in a very murky way, Greenwald shows that WikiLeaks has yet to be found to be publishing a doctored document. And he shows how over at MSDNC, they trotted out Malcolm Nance, and I've seen him on the tube quite a bit lately. He is a former intelligence official. He's an African-American. He's very articulate. And he stated that the WikiLeaks archive of Clinton and Podesta emails, quote, "Official warning, Podesta emails are already proving to be riddled with obvious forgeries and black propaganda, not even professionally done." Well, this sends Glenn Greenwald into a real rant, and you need to read it. Because, again, he doesn't cite Karl Rove, but he reflects the same intent here. "It did signal to Clinton's most devoted followers to simply ignore the contents of everything. Anyone writing articles about what these documents revealed was instantly barraged with claims from Democrats that they were fakes, by people often pointing to articles like, one from the Daily News Bin, which is a site controlled by David Brock. And it repeats the false statement from Malcolm Nance with this official warning. And Greenwald shows how that was shared 22,000 times on Facebook. Tweets were passed around in the tens of thousands. And then he exposes Kurt Eichenwald, which he describes as Newsweek's Clinton-adoring writer. Now, Eichenwald has done some good work recently exposing the international business deals of Donald Trump. But when it comes to Clinton, well, he's backing up the claim that Russia has hacked, and he's using a bizarre example that Greenwald debunks here, that an email from Sidney Blumenthal that included a link to an Eichenwald article was misconstrued by both the Trump campaign and somebody at the Sputnik news agency in Russia. And an error was made by Sputnik, which it corrected, but that's all it took. In the Rovian manner, for Team Clinton, including this friendly journalist at Newsweek, to pull that single thread and then declare, move along here. There's nothing to see. It's all garbage. It's all concocted. It's all doctored. And this is really insidious. And presuming that Clinton prevails in the election and does become the next president, this is an insight into how the media will be cowed by a Clinton White House. And the kind of payback that Tulsi Gabbard received is likely to be visited on people like Glenn Greenwald, who provide all of this inconvenient and unpleasant coverage. Here's another story, and it once again stars Neera Tanden of the Center for American Progress. You may have heard in the debate on Sunday, Donald Trump mentioned that one of the leaked emails attributed to Hillary how she had public and private positions. And then she explained that away in the debate, saying, oh gosh, I was referring to Abraham Lincoln. Well, the public position of the Clinton campaign is that there is no need currently to cut the federal corporate tax rate, which is at 35%. But just 2 years ago, this week, in a speech to the Council of Insurance Agents and Brokers, Clinton told the audience, a number of business leaders have been talking to my husband and me about the idea that would allow the repatriation of a couple of trillion dollars that are out there. And you would get a lower rate, a really low rate, if you were willing to invest a percentage in an infrastructure bank. So publicly, no need to change the corporate tax rate. But when speaking to the corporate class, she offers a different version. And currently, the size of the offshore tax-free profit pile is $2.4 trillion. That's almost 15% of the size of the American economy, which is out of circulation, stashed offshore, out of reach of American taxation, and generally just sitting there, generating a pretty low interest rate right now. But it is a fascinating insight into the way Hillary Clinton can say one thing to one group of people and something totally different to others. And here is a piece that contradicts something that she said as recently as Sunday night in the debate with Donald Trump. She once again renewed her support for a no-fly zone and safe zones in Syria. But in one of those speeches that Goldman Sachs paid her $225,000 for, this was in 2013, she had a slightly different take. She pointed to the Syrian government's air defense systems, noted that destroying them would take the lives of many Syrian civilians. Quote, they're getting more sophisticated thanks to Russian imports. To have a no-fly zone, you have to take out all of the air defense, many of which are located in populated areas. So our missiles, even if they're standoff missiles, meaning they come from offshore, so we're not putting our pilots at risk, you're going to kill a lot of Syrians. So all of a sudden, this intervention that people talk about so glibly becomes an American and NATO involvement where you take a lot of civilians. She failed to mention that in the debate on Sunday. But to Goldman Sachs, she has, a very different version of things for their consumption. And she also told a Jewish group in October 2013 that she blamed the Saudis for complicating efforts to arm the moderate Syrian rebels. Some of us thought, she said, perhaps we could, with a more robust covert action, trying to vet, identify, train, and arm cadres of rebels, that it would at least have the firepower to be able to protect themselves against both Assad and al-Qaeda-related jihadist groups that have unfortunately been attracted to Syria. That's been complicated by the fact that the Saudis and others are shipping large amounts of weapons, and pretty indiscriminately, not at all targeted toward the people that we think would be the more moderate, least likely to cause problems in the future. But this is another one of those very tough analytical problems. So, in the weeds here, she admits that Saudi Arabia has been a central player in arming the groups aligned against Assad. She doesn't mention the Islamic State, but I believe that they fit into this equation here. And so this, I think, is quite revealing. Again, the New York Times didn't see fit to put this into print. LA Times took a pass. Washington Post took a pass. And in the emails, we also learned that the Clinton Foundation leases its office space in a building controlled by Goldman Sachs. I got one more for you from The Intercept. And this is, again, based on the same emails that have been gone through by the other media outlets. And we learned that movie mogul Harvey Weinstein, a longtime ally of Hillary, a major fundraiser for her campaign, sent emails to campaign manager Robbie Mook, urging them to silence Bernie Sanders' message against police shootings of African Americans, and to counter his alignment with the thoughts of Black Lives Matter protesters. Weinstein suggested countering it with the Sandy Hook issue. Now, that is code for two things. One is to use the raw emotion to exploit the victims of the Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and to use that emotional bomb against Sanders for his position about gun manufacturer liability. And I know that that's an unpopular position, and many people just look at that and say, oh, Sanders is in camp with the NRA. Not really so. The difference between Clinton and Sanders on that issue is a valid one for political debate. But to try to smear Sanders for supporting the aspirations of African Americans and to use the dead children at Sandy Hook as the cudgel, that shows the real bare-knuckled politics of Clinton and her supporters. And there's one more item that I referenced briefly yesterday, and I want to credit David Sirota at the International Business Times. He went through the same Clinton emails and Podesta emails and showed that Hillary Clinton takes two different positions on fracking. In a March debate in Flint, Michigan, she says, "By the time we get through all of my conditions, I don't think there will be many places in America where fracking will continue to take place. We have to regulate everything that's currently underway, and we have to have a system in place that prevents further fracking unless conditions like the ones that I just mentioned are met." But when it comes to promoting fracking outside the United States, well, she was a saleswoman. Now the technology gives us the chance to go in and recover oil and gas, or with the new technology known as fracking, we're truly on a path that will be net energy exporters, assuming we do it right. And what did she tout in the debate on Sunday night? The only question that came up about energy. She didn't talk about fracking. She didn't talk about, too much about renewables. She talked about energy independence, which means that we have to continue producing at the current rate, and that means we have to keep fracking in order to remain energy independent. So I invite you to go to the show file at peterbcollins.com, click on the links that I've provided, absorb these articles for yourself, compare the coverage at The Intercept, and again, I have to give them high marks for their enterprise and their really news judgment in identifying which emails contained issues that people really need to know about. And it shows that the old line corporate mainstream media in this country is so aligned with Hillary Clinton and so eager to have access in her administration that they're no longer, and maybe I'll repudiate this, but at this point I'm concluding that they're no longer interested in fair and objective coverage of this political campaign. They are pulling punches. They're protecting Hillary Clinton. And I consider it my job to tell you that. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. This free podcast is available on YouTube, and I hope you'll share it far and wide. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.